criticize it. Legalize it, yeah, yeah, and I will advertise it. Some call it of instrument too. Legalize it, yeah, yeah, that's the best thing you can do.
Contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
When Nicole Sandler sits down to do her show, she's the producer, booking the guests, pulling the audio, planning the show, the engineer, running the controls, troubleshooting any problems, playing the sounds, calling the guests, and she's the webmaster, writing the blog, posting the podcast, maintaining the website, not to mention the host, interviewing the guests, explaining the issues, giving opinions, and calling out the bad guys, and then you get the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com.
All right, welcome. welcome to a Wednesday. I guess we could call it Weed Wednesday. I told you yesterday we were gonna take a little detour today from politics because we could all use a break from our political world every now and then, and talk a bit about medical marijuana. Today happens to be the 80th anniversary of the Marijuana Tax Act. Yep, it was August 2nd, 1937, when FDR signed that bill into law, for the first time imposing federal criminal penalties on the possession, production, and sale of cannabis. 1937. Yesterday, we saw Cory Booker introduce the Marijuana Justice Act, which would legalize cannabis on a federal level. It would still be subject to state and local laws, but do away with those federal, the federal laws that right now everyone is subject to. So a lot of progress is being made. 29 states, I believe, now have legalized medical marijuana. And here in Florida, last November, we did it. We finally passed, I think by 73% of the vote, Amendment 2. It's a constitutional amendment legalizing cannabis. And Florida, being Florida, is still going through all of the machinations trying to figure out how the law will be implemented. And the first rule of order was to get nurseries, certified to be able to sell them, to be able to grow and distribute the cannabis. And, one of our friends, somebody that you know, if you've been listening to this program for any amount of time, is one of those, or owns one of those nurseries that has been certified. Deborah Newell Tornello. I usually bring her on with the Oi Florida music, but today I'm not. We'll just say, hey, Deborah.
Hi there. How are you, my friend?
I'm fine. And I was going to say, how are you? But I know finally, you're doing well. You know, I haven't talked about it this whole time because you were in legal limbo. But I thought now that it's all said and done, the press release went out yesterday. It's official. Three Boys Farm is now one of eight certified nurseries in the state of Florida who is permitted to grow and distribute cannabis?
That's correct. We are number eight, and number nine is Plants of Ruskin. Both of us had filed challenges with the Department of Health back in late 2015, and you know what happened in that particular instance, and so here we are. It's been an incredible long haul, and we're just so relieved and so excited about the road ahead now. Now we can actually start doing things and building toward what was our intent all along, to grow the very best organic medical cannabis for Florida's patients.
Now
I'm thrilled beyond belief.
your farm, Three Boys Farm, which people can find at number3boysfarm.com, is an organic, it's more than a nursery, it's a farm. You grow organic fruits and vegetables, right? You've been doing this for a long time.
That's correct. We've been, in fact, in 2010, Robert won the Governor's Environmental Leadership Award for not just being an organic farm, but one with very innovative sustainability methods, collecting rainwater, which is a huge thing in Florida because drawing on the aquifer is what all farms and agricultural industries do. And Robert has devised ways to keep that to a minimum. And in fact, we use recycled rainwater. He also had a tremendous program recycling products, metal products to build the greenhouses, and just he devised his own organic liquid feed, became the first hydroponic farm that was also USDA certified organic. So that was back in 2010, and we've just been rolling since then. But this we worked so hard for and for so long, and our team, our doctors, including Dr. Gerdeman, who you'll be talking to and hearing from soon, and Dr. Juan Sanchez Ramos at USF, and of course our team in Tallahassee, our attorneys have been indispensable, as you can imagine, so to speak. So Yes, here we are. We can't wait.
So now, Florida, in the last legislative session, they actually came back into a special session and passed something. Do you have guidelines on how things are going to work here in Florida? Because although the law was passed it was voted in November, the law was passed a couple of months ago. We right. still don't have any guidelines out in the public. Do you know how it's going to work?
They are still formulating that. It's obviously a brand new thing. But I do know that they will be giving out more licenses, not too many more, but more as time goes by, right through October. And those licenses were brought in under the Amendment 2 Implementation Bill. And yes, they did have to go into special session because there was a lot of backroom disagreements on that, with numbers of dispensaries and this and, different demands that the current license holders had versus what other lawmakers wanted to see. And then, of course, we have some of the extreme prohibitionists chipping in and saying, well, they didn't want to see any of this, but they wanted the most restrictions possible on everything. So it was a thing. And then, of course, the session ran out and they said, well, if you're going to come back for a special session to get this done, you better have something sorted out before you bring it to the floor. And so they did, and more or less. Everything in Florida takes time, as you know, and is a work in progress. But we are really, really excited and grateful to the Department of Health for the work that they've been doing.
So Deborah Newell Tornello is with us. So do you get to start growing right away? Do you go into production and then do you build dispensaries? I mean, do the farms actually do everything?
Well, we have at the moment we have the license, and so hold on 1 second. Okay. I'm going to check with Robert as to when we can start growing. Two months.
Oh, in 2 months. Okay.
Start cultivation. Yes.
I see.
Robert. Signals. I'm not very good at reading them right now.
Robert being your husband, Robert Tornello, yes, who's the president of Three Boys Farms.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And we're the parents of the three boys, in case anyone wondered where the name came from.
I figured that. So this is exciting. So now, are you going to keep growing your fruits and vegetables and just add on to the business, or are you just...
Absolutely. Because some of the fruits and vegetables that we grow, particularly some of the herbs, have medicinal applications, like turmeric. We'll be growing that. We have been growing that organically. You might have seen some of the big pictures that I put up on Instagram and Facebook too. Ginger, moringa, which is difficult to find, but a beloved and superfood plant, really. If you want to Google it, if you're not familiar with moringa, it is a very nutritious leaf that it grows in a small tree form.
Okay. I will check that out.
Yeah, we will be growing that. It's M-O-R-I-N-G-A. And we are definitely going to keep all of that going. And the medical cannabis will be grown with using organic protocols, just as we always have with everything else that we grow. And we are going to be using the very highest level of third-party testing. So our product will be very pure and safe and reliable.
This is so exciting.
It is. I know I'm a bit tongue-tied because this is all just, it all just came down on Monday. And we're out here in Washington with our third son at camp, and we got the news, and we just finished lunch, and I wanted to jump up and down in the middle of the street. I was so excited, and I was trying to calm down, but it's funny. Robert is—he's always laughing that we've exchanged personalities. I'm now the passionate Italian, and he's the calm Brit. Not that I was ever that calm.
We keep getting a tone. So, Deborah, in a few minutes, I mentioned yesterday to the listeners that we were going to talk about the scientific medicinal properties of cannabis, and we're going to speak with your chief medical, your chief scientific officer, Greg Gerdeman. So tell us a little bit about Greg, who we're going to hear from.
Well, Dr. Gerdeman is a neuroscientist, and he was formerly teaching biology at Eckerd College, And for many years, I mean decades, he has been researching and traveling the world and researching traditional medicines, particularly cannabis as medicine. And he's been published all over the world, but here especially, his scholarly works on the endocannabinoid system, on different receptors that are involved, and I'm sure he will be able to give you a whole lot more cogent insight to all of that than I can, because he's really good at communicating the intricate science of it. But so Robert had met him years ago, and we were just determined, once we decided to go on this journey and begin growing medical cannabis and doing it organically, that we were going to bring in some of the best minds in the country. Luckily enough, two of them happen to live in our state. So that's Dr. Gerdeman and Dr. Santos Ramos. You can also Google him and find out a little bit about him. His CV was over 50 pages long, if that gives you an idea. Wow. Yeah, he is brilliant. And again, very, very, very well, what is the word, published in human endocannabinoid.
That's difficult too, because as we know, cannabis is still classified as a Schedule I narcotic here in the United States, which means it has no medicinal purposes, no medicinal uses, and the research allowed to be done on it is very limited. So that's a question that I'll have for Dr. Gerdeman, is how he's been able to do all this research under those conditions.
He will tell you it's very tricky, and he'll probably talk a little bit about Dr. Sue Sisley. She has been at the forefront of trying to push to test it for its incredible properties in helping veterans with PTSD. Hmm. But she had her efforts, and she's been on CNN with Dr. Gupta talking about that, but her efforts were stymied, and her funding was stymied by the fact that it is still Schedule I, along with drugs like heroin, which is absolutely ridiculous. I would just remind everyone, in case you're wondering why we're talking about descheduling or rescheduling and why it's so important, and why what Senator Booker is doing is really important and laudable, is that right now cannabis is regarded by the federal law as completely without medical benefit and addictive, and yet it isn't. And not only that, it has never killed anybody. It has no LD50 has ever been established. In other words, when they give a medicine to rats to test it for safety, at the point where half of them die, that's the dose considered the LD50. Well, they've never been able to find that for cannabis, because apparently there isn't one.
Wow.
It's safe. It's very safe, which is not to say that it shouldn't be carefully administered and that a doctor should be overseeing it. But to have it scheduled as a drug with no medical benefits that's as dangerous as heroin is absolute nonsense. And I'm glad that we're finally getting around to addressing that. The federal level, it seems to be moving even more slowly than at the state level. But
And we took a few giant steps backwards with our new administration and the new attorney general.
Don't get me started. Yeah. In fact, I'm kind of torn, you know, because I think a lot of us in this industry now, you know, we would like to see a more cannabis-friendly attorney general. By the same token, if our president were to fire him, a lot of people think that would be leading up to him firing Mueller.
Yep.
And quashing the investigation. We don't want that to happen. So it's a bit of a conundrum in that sense.
Well, it is, but you know what? I told myself we were going to stay away from politics today. But Dianne Feinstein just this weekend, no, that's fine, said that if Sessions is fired, that's the beginning of the end of this presidency. Then again, we have Democrats saying that. But I think Lindsey Graham said it as well. So
yeah. Now a lot of Republicans have been quietly and not so quietly saying just that. So. Cross your fingers.
Yeah, it is. It is that, you know, it's the catch 22. We need somebody better than Sessions, but we can't get rid of Sessions right now.
That's the real point about him being, you know, a rather dreadful person to have as AG in terms of cannabis. I would say that, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, 29 states have legalized either medically or full recreational. And it is a tremendous income stream for states that were previously struggling, particularly struggling for federal dollars. Colorado, for example, they have been able to completely refurbish infrastructure, build schools, brand new airport in Denver, with the revenue that is coming into them thanks to legalized cannabis. These states are not going to sit quietly if Jeff Sessions starts to mess with that. So money tends to, unfortunately or fortunately in this case, it tends to have the final word.
Right. You know, and in addition to the story that I found about Cory Booker and the fact that today is the 80th anniversary of the beginning of cannabis prohibition, there was another story about some big pharmaceutical trying to buy up some cannabis interests. You know, they're going to try to get in it. But what you're doing, just to bring it back around to you guys, the Tornellos and Three Boys Farm, are you the only organic farm in Florida that was certified?
Yes, indeed. We were not only the only organic farm, we were the only growers who grow plants for human consumption. The other nurseries who really just sold off their 30-year established presence in Florida had companies coming in from Colorado or elsewhere that basically are using their 30 years. And these nurseries are ornamental nurseries.
Wow.
And actually grew food for human consumption and organically with USDA certification and trace back and third-party audits and everything that goes along with that.
So you were wrapped up in a lawsuit against the state of Florida over the last year because of the way they scored it, where you should have been through in the first round. And Florida, being Florida, did things sort of the wrong way, but it all worked out the right way in the end, and you got your license now officially this week. But you had to be in business for 30 years in order to even apply?
That was the rule back in 2015 for the applicants that we filled in these, we wrote these long 1,000-page applications, and there were about, I think, 28 nurseries that and farms that applied. And yes, one of the to even be eligible to apply at that point, it's changed now. You had to be in business for 30 years as a Florida grower,
wow,
established in the same business, not changing hands and changing your FEIN and changing all of those things. You had to have consistent ownership. You also had to demonstrate the ability to have on site, I think it was 400,000 plants, and there were a few other rules. I'm not 100% clear, without having to look it up right now, as to what the Amendment 2 rules are going to be, but they are considerably less strict. Remember, this was put together back in 2014 when Rick Scott first signed the Compassionate Care Act, and that was just for very low THC, high CBD oil, generally for a very narrow range of patients, for children with epilepsy, mm-hmm, and a few other conditions. And
well,
that was mainly it was like hemp. It was CBD.
Sure. And that's basically what's sold in health food stores now. It's CBD,
exactly,
from hemp plants. There is no THC component in it. I guess these are things I can get into with Dr. Greg Gerdeman in a few minutes.
Yes.
Deborah Newell Tornello, I'm just so happy for you guys. Congratulations. I know this has been a long time coming, and you got a long road ahead too. So hopefully you'll stay in touch, and we'll keep everyone abreast of the progress you're making, because it's a new world that you're forging.
Absolutely. And if I may touch on this just briefly before you head over to Greg,
mm-hmm,
I just read a piece that they are not serving, the market in South Florida is really underserved and prices are very high. So we'll need to talk in the future about some locations for future dispensaries in the South Florida area. So you and I will have to put our heads together on that.
Absolutely.
I don't know the area as well as I used to when I was in high school in Miami. So you can help fill me in on the good locations.
Well, have to take a road trip, and we'll go scouting locations.
That sounds like a plan.
Yes. Deborah Newell Tornello. Find her on Twitter at LitBrit. And check out, I was looking at the website, threeboysfarm.com. Obviously, this news is so new, it's not even updated. But I do like, you've got food is medicine. So this has been your philosophy all along. And
yes, thank you for bringing that point up for me.
Yes.
Yeah. That's it.
I'm so excited to see where this goes. And I'm so happy for you guys. So congratulations again. And I'll talk to you later. Enjoy Bellingham, Washington.
Thank you. We sure are.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Say hi to Greg.
Will do. Thanks so much. All right.
Thanks, Nicola.
Bye-bye. And we'll have to do a Florida segment again sometime soon.
Oh, yes. Yes.
All right.
There's no shortage of material.
No, sadly not. All right. We'll talk later. Bye-bye. All right. So Deborah Newell Tornello, again, great news. I couldn't tell you all these, you know, years we've been talking and we had to stay quiet on this subject until it happened. It's finally happened. So we'll take a break. We'll do what's news. And then on the other side, we're going to talk to Dr. Greg Gerdeman, who is the chief scientific officer for Three Boys Farm. And we'll get at the medical science behind medical marijuana next. Don't go away. Nicole Sandler at NicoleSandler.com and on the Progressive Voices Network.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
That June 2016 Trump Tower meeting between Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, and a Russian attorney along with other Russian nationals is the story that just won't go away. Thanks to the president. The Washington Post on Monday night reported that Trump dictated his son's initial statement while on Air Force One, heading home from the G20 summit on July 8th. We know that Trump Jr. attended the meeting after being promised damaging information on Hillary Clinton as part of a Russian government effort to help his father's campaign. But his statement characterized it as a discussion about Russian adoption in his initial response. Asked about it in Tuesday's White House daily briefing, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the president weighed in, as any father would.
The statement that Don Jr. issued is true. There's no inaccuracy in the statement. The president weighed in, as any father would, based on the limited information that he had. This is all discussion, frankly, of no consequence. There was no follow-up. It was disclosed to the proper parties, which is how the New York Times found out about it to begin with. John?
Can you clarify the degree to which the president weighed in?
He certainly didn't dictate, but, you know, he, like I said, he weighed in, offered suggestion like any father would do.
Was he aware at the time that Don Jr. had a meeting that was based on the pretext that he would be promised information that was negative about Hillary Clinton when he suggested that the statement only say that the meeting was primarily about Russian adoption policy?
Like I said, the statement that was issued was true and there were no inaccuracies in the statement.
CNN's Jake Tapper responds.
To be clear, of course, the statement that Don Jr. issued that was dictated by the president, according to the Post, was misleading. It did not even remotely acknowledge the purpose of the meeting, which was Donald Trump Jr. wanting to meet someone billed as a Russian government lawyer with one specific purpose, to obtain dirt on Hillary Clinton. A meeting attended, by the way, by Jared Kushner and campaign chair Paul Manafort. Now, you as a citizen, you should expect a much higher standard of truth than the one that the White House press secretary just enunciated. If a meeting takes place so campaign officials can get dirt on a political rival from the Russian government, describing that meeting as being about adoption and not mentioning the purpose of the meeting, it's not true. It's inaccurate. It is so misleading as to be
the first Senate hearings on health care are on the calendar. Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Chairman Lamar Alexander and Ranking Member Patty Murray announced the committee will begin bipartisan hearings on September 4th on a small bipartisan stabilization package that could include funding for the Affordable Care Act's cost-sharing reduction subsidies and expanded state innovation waivers, including a provision allowing people over 30 to purchase plans that only cover catastrophic care. Last week, while speaking before law enforcement on Long Island, the president suggested police treat suspects roughly.
And when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Speaking before the National Organization of Black Law Enforcement on Tuesday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions told officers the DOJ has their back, but warned that police are not thugs.
We all know the cases of the last several years where in confrontations with police, lives have been cut short. And just as I'm committed to defending law enforcement who lawfully have to use deadly force to defend themselves while engaged in their work. I will also use the powers of the office I've been entrusted with to hold any officer responsible who violates the law. You know that all it takes is for one bad officer to destroy the reputations of so many who work every day to build good relationships in these communities and who serve with honor and distinction.
Speaking of the Department of Justice, the New York Times is reporting that the Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources of its civil rights division toward investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admission policies deemed to discriminate against white applicants. MSNBC's Joy Reid explains.
The New York Times reports that the Justice Department plans to take on affirmative action in college admissions. Quote, the Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division toward investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admissions policies deemed to discriminate against white applicants, according to a document obtained by the New York Times. The document, an internal announcement to the Civil Rights Division, seeks current lawyers interested in working for a new project on investigations and possible litigation related to intentional race-based discrimination in college and university admissions. What the New York Times is describing tonight is a Justice Department operating in a way that is radically different under Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The initiative to uproot affirmative action appears to be coming not from the career staff at the Justice Department, but from the political appointees. That raises questions about whether career staff in the Civil Rights Division will begin leaving the Justice Department rather than staying on and carrying out a mission that has gone upside down from what it used to be. I got the
news. And that's a bit of What's News for Now. I'm Nicole Sandler. Remember, my work is 100% listener supported, and we can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.
The Nicole Sandler Show is 100% listener supported. Have you given yet? Nicole decided not to put her show behind a paywall, knowing that many can't afford the luxury of paying for a podcast. But if you're able to, she needs your financial support to continue doing this. Consider a monthly subscription. Give when you can. Just visit NicoleSandler.com/donate. Remember, she can't do this without you.
All right, I am back, and hopefully he's there. Dr. Greg Gerdeman is the chief scientific officer at Three Boys Farm. They just received their license as a medical marijuana treatment center in Florida, the state's eighth licensee. Greg is a leading neuroscientist with specialization in the area of cannabinoid science. His scholarly works have been published around the world, and he's a frequent guest speaker at medical cannabis conferences, most recently in Melbourne, Australia. Greg, welcome home, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay?
I hear you just fine. So great. Hopefully this will work. We should have probably tested it ahead of time. It's so nice to meet you. As I don't know if you know, but Deborah and I have been friends for a while, and I've followed from sort of afar their whole process of getting to this point, and it's very exciting. So how long have you been working with them?
Gosh, over 2 years. I met Robert Tornello in 2014 around activism to legalize cannabis for medicine the first time around as Amendment 2. He, at some of the sort of public debates that I was participating in, and then I got brought in the spring of 15 to try and help write their application and be part of the team that we put together, and it's been an arduous journey since then, but feeling very good about it.
But now you've been studying cannabis and the science behind it for 20 years now, right?
Yes, since I started my PhD work, really, at Vanderbilt University in 96.
Wow. So, you know,
so I've been studying it a long time.
Yeah, it sounds that way. I'm hoping you can give us, you know, we've all heard of all the different things. I spoke briefly with Deborah a few minutes ago about CBDs and how what's sold now. You can go into any health food store and you can get a bottle of CBD oil. That's from hemp, right? The stuff you can get over the counter anywhere is made
of stuff you can get. Yes. Yeah, stuff you can get over the counter anywhere is ostensibly made from a hemp variety that will have under a limit of 0.3% THC total, like cannabinoid content. If you're living in other states, that's not necessarily the case. There are CBD oil products that are made from more drug varieties of cannabis with, you know, higher content altogether, even though there may be predominantly or almost exclusively CBD. But stuff you can get off Amazon or order online or go to any number of, and there are hundreds of CBD hemp oil companies that have popped up in just the last year. And these are all being derived from, you know, there's a large variety of sources that they're coming from, but they are all claiming to be legal under a national hemp farming bill that says that it would be coming from a hemp variety.
Okay. So if we're going to start talking about, what's the difference between what you would get from hemp and what you would get from a cannabis plant?
Well, you know, it really does depend on the actual product. You know, I don't want to make too many blanket statements, but if the processes are equal, if you've got like the same sort of flow through similar between more of a high producing cannabis strain or variety, I tend to avoid the word strain actually. Then there are some differences, primarily in the overall abundance. I mean, so there's differences in the agriculture, in the practice. If it's coming from hemp, the overall amount of CBD is really quite low, even though it predominates over THC. So there's a lot of acreage, there's a lot of biomass that has to be processed, consumed, you know, dedicated to making the oils. So many of the products that are coming out require a certain level of secondary processing to enrich that CBD. A lot of products are actually just buying what's called CBD isolate. That's really a chemically isolated, crystallized CBD powder that's essentially added into their various botanical blends. And, you know, the bottom line is all sources are not equal. And a lot of products don't, for example, have lab testing. They'll say it's 99.something% pure THC, but,
right,
you know, as a chemist, 0.1% is a lot if a contaminant in there. Other issues can, you know, include that because there's so much more of the biomass of the plant required, you get accumulation from metals in the soil and that kind of thing. So it just becomes very important that the source is properly, you know, tended, you know, organic methods, that you've got real agronomists behind it. And many, many products of these hundreds of hemp oil companies are not so transparent and are, you know, maybe processing extracts that get shipped over from Eastern Europe or China. People talk to me, I have different recommendations, and they include companies that I think are highly transparent, are sourcing domestically from like the best processes,
right,
in the U.S.
All the more reason why we want three boys to get up and running soon. So we have locally grown organic, a known source, and you know that it's going to be done right. Dr. Gerderman, I'd like to back up and talk about what CDBs are, CBDs are, and what the endocannabinoid system is. That's what your expertise is in the physiological actions of cannabis and the endocannabinoid system. What is the endocannabinoid system?
The endocannabinoid system is a major physiological cellular mechanism in our bodies, in all animals, at least in all vertebrate animals. I mean, there's different, I can go down a lot of wormholes there, but in human beings, the endocannabinoid system is a key mechanism of cell signaling. It's how cells in the body communicate with their neighbors. It helps cells to achieve what we call homeostasis, that they're maintaining balance of the proper relationship in sort of the networks of cells that make up tissues and organ systems. So it's a way that cells communicate. The endocannabinoid system, you know, it can be arcane to people who don't study molecular physiology, but
right.
It was discovered by understanding how cannabis works. I mean, basically, since the early 1960s, we had these molecules in hand, THC and CBD, cannabidiol, as the primary cannabinoid components in cannabis. The cannabinoid refers to this family of molecules that are structurally similar and that are at least originally thought only created in the cannabis plant. And in fact, these molecules are only created in the cannabis plant, although other plant products interact with the system in different ways. But, you know, so from the early 60s for the next 30 years, there was a big endeavor to figure out how these molecules are working. And in really the late 80s, early 90s, we came to discover a set of receptors that are proteins that sit on cells that are how cells receive these molecules and why THC works in the brain the way it does. And throughout the body, causes all the physiological, pharmacological effects of cannabis, is because of THC acting on these receptors and other cannabinoids acting there. But very shortly on the heels of that discovery were the so-called endocannabinoids, the innate molecules we have, the neurotransmitters, if you will, that act the same way, our body's own THC-like molecules. So our endocannabinoids are something that have existed in our ancestors for hundreds of millions of years and are part of how our incredible brains and immune systems and organ systems have evolved. And the cannabis plant evolved in a way that interacts with that and in a lot of very fascinating ways. So those molecules that cannabis makes include the cannabinoids. THC and CBD are the real twin stars of the cannabinoid entourage. There are others that have exciting potential therapeutic values. I refer to them as cannabinoids. CBD itself is a singular molecule, so saying CBDs is not quite right.
Gotcha.
Because CBD is a molecule of its own. And it interacts with the endocannabinoid system in very different ways than THC and in ways that are not nearly as obvious as THC.
Well, the THC obviously has the component that gets you high. That's where the high comes from. But CBD does not have that psychoactive component, right? Or does?
Well, I will dig into the words a little bit.
Okay.
I mean, you're generally totally right there, but what do we mean by high and what do we mean by psychoactive? THC certainly is the primary factor leading to the profound psychoactivity that we think about of the high. But for one thing, other molecules that are now getting called entourage molecules that are fragrances, the aromatic molecules we call terpenes, that are not unique to cannabis, but are part of the flavor smell profile. Some of them have very important effects on the manner in which one gets high or experiences psychoactivity, whether it makes you, kind of dozy or not, or whether it helps to elevate you and sharpen your attention. Cannabis can do that. And to that end, cannabidiol has distinct activity at influencing, relieving anxiety we don't know that that's going to happen with every person all the time, but there's great evidence that cannabidiol can have anxiety relieving properties, antidepressant properties. And that to me is fundamentally a mood elevation of sorts. It's the original meaning of high. So in that it impacts your mental state of clarity, wellness, sense of being, if that's part of what is bundled up into the high, it's certainly not just THC. There are sort of uplifting monoterpenes that are again, these fragrance molecules that are present in some varieties of cannabis, largely absent from what's on the street.
Hmm.
And CBD participates as well.
So, you know, when you talk about the different varieties, and obviously the different varieties of the plant have different characteristics. And when it comes to, some that may act as an antidepressant or a mood elevator or anti-anxiety, the different varieties, some are stronger or better at it than others. This all goes back to research. And cannabis is a Schedule I narcotic. It's how it's classified here in the U.S. How are you able to do the research when by the means of it being a Schedule I, that means the government has said it has no medicinal value and therefore you can't even do the research? How have you been able to research it all these years?
Well, you know, I have not been researching with the cannabis plant. Ah. I mean, my background is really truly in the neurophysiology of how it works, but you know, I'm someone who worked for years with mice and lab rats and studying brains at a cellular and molecular level and following very closely all the literature and going to meetings. And when human research has been done, I've been very much in touch with those people and following it. And I'm part of that community. But you're, of course, quite right. I mean, all of the things I've just said about, you know, certain varieties being more, you know, anxiety relieving, et cetera, et cetera. This is conjecture that's based on a lot of human report, a lot of, you know, sort of N of one clinical observations that get dismissed as anecdote, and also a ton of animal research that is, you know, tax funded, NIH funded animal research. Millions of animals have given their lives into this kind of discipline, and the weight of evidence, the preponderance of it, is very, very strong that,
right,
one, of course cannabis has medicinal properties. The Schedule I status has never, ever been based in science.
And other countries,
and that secret is long,
right?
Ridiculous reason it remains.
And other countries, I think most notably Israel, does a lot of real research on cannabis. They don't have any such silly restrictions, do they?
Well, Israel is an interesting, unique case. I mean, there has been a lot of research going on there over the years and funded by the NIH. And even clinical research there, you know, early and sort of the early phase clinical trials can be done in Israel and then accepted by the FDA, even though they didn't have the DEA hoop. There's a really interesting sort of unique Israel loophole in the DEA's stranglehold on this. I won't go down that, you know, wormhole, but I mean, Israel's has had a good research portfolio. Other countries have as well. I mean, the progress of science that's really kind of liberated cannabis from this drug of abuse paradigm has been global. I mean, from Japan and Australia and Israel and Europe and the US and Canada, there's just tremendous mountain of evidence that would have moved cannabis into so many clinical trials 20 years ago if it were any other substance.
Isn't that amazing? I know
in
that,
my view.
Right. The, you know, they're showing that I think there have been some studies or there's evidence that shows that it is great for some returning veterans with PTSD. But again, can we have trials with it?
Right. And again, you know, as someone who has been so involved with animal research over the years, I feel a particular onus, a burden of, you know, that we respect that as investment has been made. And there with PTSD, the animal models are really resounding. And there've actually are things that have justified all kinds of pharmaceutical medications. This whole psychobiology of learned helplessness and how you become more susceptible to all kinds of illness and disease. The animal models that are relevant to post-traumatic stress are very clearly relevant to the human condition. And the work that shows that the endocannabinoid system is above buffer to these things. The endocannabinoids and the cannabinoid receptors are our intrinsic physiological, neurological buffer to be resilient to the effects of uncontrollable stress. And if you're not resilient, you're vulnerable and you become traumatized and you become more vulnerable to later immunological problems. And so the basic science arguing that we should be pursuing cannabis for post-traumatic stress vigorously is tremendous. And that's where, you know, the first, you know, the only real, you know, human clinical trials, I shouldn't say the only, but, you know, some of the more publicized work, Dr. Sue Sisley's work to get a study of veterans with post-traumatic stress, that's moved forward, but only achingly slow, just fighting the government tooth and nail at every step to try and bring this very, very promising natural medicine to people who have served. And of course, PTSD is not unique only to veterans, and it's it's one of many different trauma-related anxiety disorders that could be treated very effectively. I'd love to start, and I look very forward to helping to push these dyes forward and ask questions like, what varieties are more effective than others? Are these different terpene components what's important? You know, some people say that THC and CBD are kind of like the engine underneath the hood of a car, but whether you're driving a Corvette or a minivan depends on the terpene entourage as far as the experience of what's going on. This is an exciting thing. There's all kinds of conjecture because it's product-driven in many ways. There are people who will exaggerate all kinds of claims. There needs to be good research, but it needs to be in human beings in the light of day who are already willing to use this. We know beyond it what we know for clearly is that it's a safe medicine to try.
Mm-hmm.
And so that should unleash the research machines, the commerce. I mean, it can be privately funded. There's so much interest in this.
In the states where
it's an incredibly safe medicine to try.
In the states where medical marijuana has been legal and in use for years, I mean, they may not be AMA sanctioned studies, but I've got to believe that there are scientists doing research with volunteers who want to know what variety of cannabis or terpenes or whatever works best for a specific ailment. I know we've been talking about, you know, psychological ailments, anxiety and depression and PTSD, but there's a lot of evidence that shows that cannabis has cancer, anti-carcinogenic properties as well. I've known people who've used it on skin cancer and seen skin cancers disappear. I've heard the stories, like I'm a lung cancer survivor, and when I was diagnosed, did a lot of research, and I believe that those cures are out there. What do you know about the cannabis and cancer?
Well, I mean, could there be a more important thing to really put effort towards with eyes open and moving past the silly stigmas that, that hold it back? Absolutely. You know, I'm a very classically trained NIH-funded, NIDA-funded, which is the Institute on Drug Abuse, pharmacologist. I was skeptical at claims of cannabis. I mean, it's been clear that cannabis has medical value for the treatment of, you know, nausea and the toxicity of chemotherapy. That's very clear therapeutic outcome that should be very important. And I think, frankly, you know, well before I got affiliated with a company that's going to be growing cannabis, I've been saying for well over 10 years, every single cancer patient should have the right to be obtaining high quality cannabis if they start a regimen of treatment. But I didn't know what to think about the idea of cannabis as an actual frontline anti-cancer, anti-neoplastic treatment in its own right. Now I'm convinced. It's not going to work for every person all the time, and there is great need for research to dial this kind of thing in. But that many of the clinical successes, and that's what I'm calling, you know, these individual anecdotal, you know, observations, they're clinical successes. And there's, yeah, I'm very compelled to believe that we'll have managed their cancer, if not cured it, success in cannabis as the primary medicine. But it also, I mean, a lot of the basic science, including animal and cell culture research and what have you, part of what's compelling is the idea of using it synergistically, taking a multi sort of network level approach at cancer. Cancer is a very, you know, it's a whole spectrum of things that happens to us. It's not a singular disease, as you know. Anybody's one tumor mass is not a singular cancer once it starts to grow. And taking medicines that are intrinsically gentle and act at multiple modes of multiple targets. Cannabis gets called historically kind of a dirty drug because it hits multiple targets, but and not just the cannabinoid receptors that were originally identified. And there are multiple products in cannabis, some of which are not at all unique to it. And the way to talk about that I like is that it has pleiotropic actions, which means it works synergistically. It works in multiple network level ways to promote healing, growth of new cells. It's remarkable. It stimulates neurogenesis, which is the growth of new neurons. And, you know, anti-cancer chemotherapy treatments, radiation and chemotherapy, are notoriously terrible on the brain. Cannabis promotes the growth of cells you want and causes many of the cancer line cells that you don't want to commit suicide. We don't know all the reasons, but we know a lot of mechanisms. And it should be moving, again, it should move forward robustly. And if the FDA doesn't fit it into their single molecule models, which have been based in the chemistry and pharmaceutical industries as they've evolved in the last century, then they should step aside. And I mean, that's a fairly, in many of my circles, a pretty controversial thing to say, but we should be allowed at least to have robust observational studies where people can chart very clearly what kinds of cannabis they're taking. And that's something that ostensibly still could be done very well in the state of Florida. There's a lot I could critique about what's going on setting up this thing in the state of Florida, including that it has been more about who makes money than the honoring the medicine. But there is possibility to have – what needs to be done is that patients need to have a reliable source of cannabis products that are accurate as labeled, and they're grown safely, that they're not going to be getting other toxins with absolute transparency. And you mentioned stuff about other states and other studies. And part of the – there's much complexity there, but a lot of it is patients don't have steady supply. They don't know what they're getting. Mm-hmm. What they're getting is often mislabeled. They get called by these different strain names. And yeah, I'll throw a little pitch in there. People get very sensitive to calling cannabis marijuana because of its history. I'm part of a few people who want to say, let's stop calling them strains, because botanically we don't say that you have a strain of a rose. We say there's a variety of it. Mm-hmm. Strain is something that is used for viruses and bacteria and infectious microbes and cannabis. And the industry has created this whole nomenclature of calling our medicine by its strain name. And really what's
worse is
that
the names are often really goofy. They're, you know, Girl Scout cookies.
And what worse is that they're arbitrary.
Right.
I mean, they get a lot of growers, you know, this is all changing because of the application of real high-level science, plants getting their DNA sequenced, we know, and we're learning a lot of high-selling products that and genetics that are being grown in different places are not accurate as labeled. And these terms like indica and sativa are very often garbage. I mean, botanically they exist and they're real, but the plant has been so extensively hybridized that just because you got something and the breeder said, I know that this is breeding true sativa, it may not be true at all. And so when it comes to high quality research and really being able to get that special holy grail that people want to be able to say, oh my gosh, I've got Crohn's disease. What's the right variety for me? What's the right preparation for me? We're kind of a long way from that. Right now, the great satisfaction and excitement should be, it's got a lot of promise and it's remarkably safe to try. It could very well help, especially if there's plenty of CBD present. THC is also very much a medicine, but I think CBD should be around for most indications. It could probably help. It's very unlikely to hurt. And if we're engaging the health community and you know, the patient advocate community, if everybody's transparent and having a community sort of engagement, which is how this plant has emerged from prohibition, mm-hmm. Then there's some bright horizons ahead.
Well, that's, and so then we're here at the right time. And Dr. Greg Gerdeman, I'm guessing that with Three Boys Farm, you as the chief scientific officer will be able to at least study it on your own, label them on your own, and observe, I'm hoping, and we get to
well,
move
we'll
forward.
We'll be studying the plant, and we'll be caring about how it's raised and how we interact with the environment, and we'll be working really closely with patients and clinicians to learn as much as we can about
Terrific.
What helps them.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We are just hitting the top of the hour. Dr. Greg Gerdeman, I look forward to meeting you when you guys get up and running. I'm sure we'll talk again.
Likewise.
Thank you very much
Thank
for
you
your time
so
today. Take care. Bye-bye.
Take care.
It's a fascinating subject, and we're just scratching the surface of it. We've got a lot to learn. The FDA better get off its ass. See ya, we're torn on Jeff Sessions. All right, tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein and back to politics. Thanks for listening. Nicole Sandler for the Progressive Voices Network.
Yeah. car. They're stony when you're playing your guitar. Yes, but I would not feel so all alone. Everybody must get stoned. All right. Home. They stone you and then say they'll operate.